26th, and this is the second part of licensing for the internet. By the way, has anyone gone back and listened to any of these yet? Are they of value, or you just leave them until you're preparing for the exam, or you never listen to them at all? I don't know. I figure I'll do them, and nothing else, I've got a copy, I guess. So we spoke last class about all the different ways that the internet can be used, and all of the different technologies and media and applications all flowing across this network. And they do have some similarities, obviously. They are all digital, because this is a digital network, which means that it's broken up. Everything you send across the internet is broken up. I do this whenever I talk about this in cyber law or cybercrime. I show the little Mike TV scene from the original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, where it's broken up the little teeny tiny pieces, and it's sent along the air, and it's put back together all in the right pieces, and that's the internet. So whether it's voice or email or pictures or movies or anything, it's broken up into little teeny tiny pieces and sent across the line and put back into the right order on someone's screen. If it's content, one of the things that is common to all of this is that it is a perfect copy at the other end. And there can be a million perfect copies. So when you're concerned about the protection of intellectual property, you need to be aware, and you need to make your clients aware, that if they post something, either themselves or through a license relationship, that content may well be duplicated elsewhere, and it will be out of their control. And there are some technical things one can do to help. Well, I should say, to make it more difficult for end users to make copies. But that's it. It's more difficult at best. It is never impossible. So, for example, let's go back to our Netflix. Netflix is streamed. It is streamed through, I guess, the Microsoft Silverlight plugin, I think, on websites or its own app on mobile. You know, one doesn't download a video from Netflix, right? You actually download small bits of it at a time, which you can tell because if you cut your connection, it will keep playing for a while and then it will stop. But you don't have a local copy of the whole film, of the whole video, on your computer. Does that mean that it cannot be copied by the user? What do you think? No. It doesn't. Just brainstorm. How might the user copy it?
Video camera.
Video camera. Yeah. I don't know. Actually, it's probably better with old monitors. You'd get that because you'd have a different refresh rate between the camera and the monitor. That's why when you see on old TV shows, they're looking at screens. It looks like there's this bar going across. You're like, how could that's not what it looked like to them. That's just two different refresh rates. But I think with laptop screens, you don't really get that anywhere near the same way. So if nothing else, someone could take a nice stable screen, nice properly focused close-in camera, maybe mic the, you know, take the audio from the movie and mic it into the camera. You've got essentially a perfect copy. Is it broadcast quality? I don't know. Might be. The same, by the way, is true with images. You might find websites where you want to download, take a picture from a screen and download. You hit your right mouse button. If you have one, it says, oh, we've blocked right mouse button. Screenshot, done. Photograph, done. Might lose some resolution, might not. So how else could you possibly record Netflix streaming without pointing a camera at the screen? Think lower tech.
VCR.
Yeah. You plug an external, you know, you can always put a monitor into your computer. most computers. So between the, instead of plugging a monitor in, you plug some sort of video recorder. And you just record what would be going to the monitor in the sound. This is easy. It's out of your client's control. Anything that is made available online can, in theory, not may, it's still not legal, but can be duplicated and then redistributed and modified. So just as when your client has significant trade secrets, significant confidential information, you need to counsel your client that a non-disclosure agreement prohibits but doesn't prevent disclosure. So too here, a license may prohibit misuse, but it cannot prevent it. The fact that it's a perfect digital copy at a distance is common to everything on the internet. That's just how the technology works. And that has practical implications and legal implications. The fact that there are few geographic limitations. We talked a little bit about online casinos that can basically detect with some degree of accuracy whether you're in the state before they let you online, but that's not 100% accurate. And if your client has geographic restrictions, it needs to understand that whatever technology your client uses to try to make those geographic limitations automatic will never be 100% certain. As one very basic example of this, there are a number of plugins now for your browsers that allow you, they're called proxy services. And they have a variety of potential uses. One very well-regarded one for security purposes, for not being trackable, is called the Onion Router, or Tor. And essentially what that does is, rather than connecting you directly to the website that you want to look at, it will automatically route your request through a variety of different other computers, and it's all peer-to-peer. They'll go through you, you'll go through them, so that if anybody is at the other end saying, who's checking out this website, there is no way for them to actually track it back. I don't want to say no way. There's no easy, commonly available way to track it back to you. So that's one use for that is discretion. But another use for proxy services is getting around geographic locations. Because it's not simply, okay, I want to turn on this proxy service, and I don't care where in the world the other end thinks I am, as long as it doesn't know that I'm the one asking. No. There are a number of proxy services free of charge available where you can say, I would like the person at the other end, the site at the other end, to think I'm in the UK. And what it does is it routes you through a proxy, and the last stop is a computer in the UK, and that's from where your request goes. So if, for example, you happen to be a fan of Top Gear, UK, the real Top Gear, BBC, in the UK, one can watch Top Gear's episodes as soon as they've been shown on the BBC's website. But if I were to go from here, for example, and I went to bbc.co.uk/Top Gear. Okay. I went to this website. It's not just Top Gear, but it's all these BBC shows. Okay. It says here, latest episode, watch now.
At least 2 months left me.
Meaning that they'll keep it up live for, but look, BBC iPlayer TV program is are available to play in the UK only, but all BBC iPlayer radio programs are available to you. Why? Why? Rights agreements. License restrictions. Rights agreements mean that the BBC iPlayer television programs are only available to users to download and stream in the UK. However, we are aware of demand for an international version. BBC Worldwide has launched the BBC iPlayer app for iPad and iPhone in various countries. I don't know if anyone's tried this. Does it work here? But anyway, you cannot watch BBC programs in the US. Well, that's not entirely true, is it? Because if you take one of these commonly available proxies and you add it to your browser and you set it to say, anytime I'm on the BBC website, I want to pop out from a UK proxy, all of a sudden this works. He says, and vice versa. So the idea of geographic restrictions, absent physical geographic restrictions, are at best a hope. And so in thinking about the internet and licensing and restrictions and the commitments your clients are going to either require and rely upon or be willing to make, you have to be very careful about absolutes. Be interesting to find out if these rights agreements to which the BBC refers are an express absolute commitment by the BBC not to make those programs available to people outside of the UK. Because if they are, they've been breached. Because they are available to people outside the UK, because the method that the BBC uses is a technology method. And there are technological ways around technology methods. So if the contract says that the BBC will use commercially reasonable efforts and using available technologies, that's okay, because they have. That's where the wording matters. That's why you need to understand this stuff, so that when your client is either relying on this as a licensor or promising it to the licensor as a licensee, and you're looking at the proposed agreement or you're drafting the proposed agreement, you need to watch out for the absolutes. You need to say, you know, client, you don't have the technical ability to promise this 100% of the time. There are ways around it, and so don't promise something you can't fulfill. Or don't expect something from someone else that they can't reasonably. You can ask for it, but if you get it, you know, let's say you're the licensor and you're licensing to the BBC and you require the BBC to say in its contract, yes, at the BBC, we will not enable anyone outside the UK to view your program on our website. And let's say that the program creator has gotten that concession from the BBC. What does that language give the program creator? Does it give the program creator what it wants? Does it give the program creator the fact of not being available outside the UK? No. What does it give the program creator? But if the BBC says it will not be available, in its contract. Let's say they don't have smart solicitors or barristers. I never would know. I guess it's the solicitor's draft and the barrister's argument. Anyway, they have smart lawyers. They don't have smart lawyers who know this stuff. And they actually wrote into their rights agreements, it will not be available from our website outside the UK. What do the content creators get from that nice language? What do you think they get?
They think that it's not going to be available no matter what.
Right.
That's what they think.
That's what they think. What do they actually get?
But they're not going to get that.
No, the most they get is an additional claim in a breach of contract action. But that's not what they're going for. And they may require the BBC to say that because they, in turn, have licenses under which they're acting. They're licensing content to create the program that they're then handing off to the BBC to broadcast and to post. And their licenses require them to get that from somebody else. And so all the way up the chain, there may be reliance on something that isn't true. Language can be there, but it doesn't mean it's true. So how are people using IP of various kinds online in all these media with all these problems? It can be the content of a site. It can be in advertisements, in banner ads and product placement and text. It can be within email, the underlying technology, music, video, names and trademarks, and so on. Interesting thing, again, that came up, something I was looking at this week relevant to this. Is that what it was? Statement of Rights and Responsibilities. So this is the Facebook Statement of Rights and Responsibilities. And it turns out there are special provisions applicable to advertisers on Facebook. Take a look at, and these are the things that you say. So there are all these, so one of course is, okay, if I'm creating advertisements for Facebook, as I said last time, I need to make sure that if I've got stock photos or releases from people whose pictures are there or brands that I'm showing in some way, that I have the rights to post them on Facebook. But that's not all. See what this says. This is what you agree to as an advertiser if you use Facebook for advertising. You agree that, and this is we, is Facebook, your from the advertiser. So we, Facebook, can use your ads and related content and information for marketing or promotional purposes. It's not an unreasonable thing for Facebook to say. They want to show screenshots of their own service, including these advertisements, including this content. But if you've got a client who is posting an ad to Facebook and asks you, what do I need to know about this? You need to tell your client, not only does it have to be concerned that it has the rights from whatever content it's licensed to post an ad to Facebook, it needs to have the rights to sublicense to Facebook. This is a sublicense. Do you see that? It doesn't say license, it doesn't say sublicense. But this is Facebook requiring advertisers to grant Facebook the rights to use the ads and related content and information for Facebook's marketing and promotions purposes. So you need to actually think about these licensing issues in terms of the rights, just like we were looking, I guess, at the Instagram terms of use, right? The terms of service. And Instagram requiring the right to redistribute, etc. Same as here with Facebook. And it's not just the users who, you know, they're going to think, okay, I'm posting a picture to Facebook, that's fine. It's the advertisers who don't necessarily have a relation. They may not even be working directly with Facebook. They may be working with an advertising agency, and the agency is doing an ad buy for them. And one of the places they're posting the ads is on Facebook. And suddenly the client, the advertiser, is granting a license it didn't know it had to grant and might not have the rights to do it. I know we're sort of all over the place, but I'm really trying to convey to you that the internet is different. It is truly different because of this lack of control, because of the so many different ways that something posted online can be distributed, reused, remixed, shared, out of the control of the content creator. It's probably among the main reasons why the internet has been such a cultural phenomenon, has generated so much cultural shift, because every user is now a worldwide broadcaster, potentially. We have access to audiences, whether or not they want to hear from us. We have access to audiences at zero cost all over the world. But so do businesses. And you have to remember how far flung the IP may end up being used in structuring these license relationships. So, among the challenges of the internet for licensing, immediacy. The moment something goes online, it is everywhere. There's no pulling it back. This isn't, you know, planning an ad buy in a magazine and then before the magazine goes to press, making a change, or pulling the ad, or doing something. You rarely have issue. The challenges you have with traditional media are very different. Why are you buzzing at me, phone? Very different. With the internet, it's up, it's there. Now, that's a benefit, too. When advertisers, I should say marketers, first got online, anyone know what direct marketing is? How it differs from just pure advertisements? Has anyone studied marketing? You know about direct marketing?
I think so. It's targeted to specific demographics or groups, so potential clients.
Right. And how is it? That's half of direct marketing. But the other half is measurement. Lester Wunderman, who was one of the... Rachel, stop calling my daughter. She's not here. My daughter's friend is calling my daughter, I think, on my phone for some reason. Lester Wunderman, W-U-N-D-E-R-M-A-N, who was one of the pioneers of direct marketing. Worth looking him up. He really put together this methodology for testing, fine-tuning ads, fine-tuning pitches. So you would take two different versions in the most basic sense of an advertisement and send it to two different populations or two different channels. And you would make it so you could figure out which one worked. You see this in magazines. You see this on infomercials. Call 800-555-1212 and ask for extension 134. There's no extension 134. That just tells them which version of the commercial on which channel, which night you watched. Because another channel would be extension 135. And so the marketers very quickly can determine which things are working, and then they test again. And that's the key to direct marketing. But there's a life cycle to that. You've got to figure it out, you've got to put it out, and then you have to wait. The internet has turned direct marketing into an instantaneous process. You can put up an ad, one can put up an ad, measure its results, and then instantly swap it for a different ad, because all these ads are being fed in real time, and see if that one works better, or split the demographics. You get immediate feedback and the immediacy of change, which is a wonderful tool. It's a wonderful tool, but it also means that if you've got something out there and you don't have the rights, it is instantly everywhere, and that's a problem. Yeah.
I was just thinking, because yesterday in the excellent you showed us the archives.
Yep, archive.org.
So now, if you have an agreement that you're only allowed to use content for like
good question.
A year, and that thing is now dating back to 96, so
yep.
Now are you breaching because it's still on that?
So what he's talking about, for those of you who don't take two classes, God, how many hours a week are you guys with me? Those of you who are there, if you're not familiar, you can see I'm going to get through about two slides tonight, which is fine. This is important. If you're not familiar with this website, you need to be. This is called the Internet Wayback Machine. Yes, like Sherman and Mr. Peabody, I pointed out. And now that's relevant to people because there's a new movie. I only leave it on because if it were my wife calling and she calls three times, then I know family emergency and I'll excuse myself. You know, time was they could call the office and ask to be connected. We don't have that. But anyway, web.archive.org. You need this in your bookmarks, in your favorite places, whatever. This will revolutionize your practice as a lawyer and as a person, because what this is, if you're not familiar with it, is a dated archive of numerous websites dating back, in some cases, 18 years. 1996, Alexa Internet started archiving copies of websites, not just home pages. Every page that was linked, they would then copy, and they would date it, and then they'd go back again. And what you can do with this is, for example, can't do Facebook, right? So, I don't know, where might we see content licensed? Who knows? Fun. So here we have the BBC website. Let me shrink this down. Between December 21st, 1996 and February 25th, 2014, there have been 16,547 versions of that page stored. This is the BBC website on December 21st, 1996. Very exciting it was. Programs. Let's see what we have here. Can you see these? Lives of Jesus, the network, Operation See Here, Trip Trap, a new film by Lucy Gannon for BBC Television. So the point here is what we're saying here is, let's say the BBC had the rights to post these in 1996. Nope, not those things. Let's say the BBC had the rights to use this image. It had a 1-year license from whoever created that creepy looking stock photo image to post its website So as of December of 1996, this was a perfectly valid use. But here we are in February of 2014, and there it still is. Not on the BBC website, but of the BBC website, because Alexa Internet has captured it. Now, you could sort of wonder about the intellectual property rights of Alexa Internet. And there's all sorts of really good fair use arguments, and they're pretty confident, I think, on that stuff. And one can opt out of this, and their takedown notices, and they do all that good stuff. But I think the question is, what was the BBC's obligation? And if this were a limited term license, does a licensee have the obligation to go out and find archived copies and make them go away? Probably not. And there's really no practical way to find all the archived copies. But this one is a particular, is a particular interest. The TW QuickTime movie license. So let's see. Can we watch a movie that was posted then? Because these are files. A lot of these files. It's a fish. Very exciting. They have the technology now to show you a fish. Ooh, fish. This fish was posted in 1997, I think, or was archived in 1997. This isn't just a website. This is a video embedded in the website. You start thinking about this. It's powerful as hell. It's scary if, you're the fish content owner and you did not want it out there forever. I have used the web.archive.org to find old versions of software and other things that used to be up and aren't anymore. Because if they were stored files, it's entirely likely that, similar to this, they were stored when this page was archived. Our webcam. Howard eating. Ooh, webcam. This is just so bizarre. You know, if someone said to you, do you think that videos that were posted in 1997 are still up online? You'd probably say no. But yes. Yes, they are. Unintentionally ironic. We're going to be maintaining and building the content of this page. So if there are any extracts you particularly remembered and enjoyed, then let us know. Give us as much information as possible. We'll do our best to track it down.
So if you're licensing something to, and you know it's going to be posted on the internet, you don't expressly state in your agreement that upon termination of this license, you need to remove licensed material. Are you assuming that it's going to be, you're basically giving them the right to keep it up? You're just going to that,
again, really good question. Just like, well, we call those implied licenses. Anybody who posts anything on the web, for example, it's pretty well established, is granting all of us an implied license to make a copy of that thing. Why? Because that's the way websites work. When you view a website, you are requesting from the server a copy of everything that makes up that website to be sent to you and shown on your screen. If it weren't that way, then you'd only get one person viewing at a time. Now, there's nobody who says, or very few people will say, by accessing this website, we give you a copy, a right to make a single copy, but that's implied. So what's the implied license? I guess, is there a universal implied license when anyone licenses content to websites for it then to be archived at web.archive.org indefinitely? Maybe. So how do you deal with it? If your client doesn't want this, well, first of all, your client may not know about it. That's where you score points. Did you know? But here's what your website looked like 5 years ago and 10 years ago. Did you know it's still up there? Oh my God. We thought that was the worst website we ever saw. And it's still there, it's got our brand on it? Ah. But if they don't want that happening, what do you do about it? Well, what you do about it, potentially, is you need to say, to the licensee, dear licensee, please block web.archive.org. And they can do that by putting something called a robots.txt file on their web server. I know we're getting technical, but to answer the question, what you need to understand is, if your client doesn't want this to happen, you need to write into the agreement a block for it to happen in the first place, not an obligation to take it down. Because that is barn door, horse escaped, way too late. But it turns out there's a technical means for websites to put up basically a sign on their electronic front door. And when Google comes crawling along, and when Alexa Internet's archive.org comes crawling along, the first thing they check, these well-behaved search engines and archive sites, is whether you have a robots.txt little text file right at the top level of the server. And in that text file, the owner of the website can say, this site, I don't want you to archive me. Google, well, why you would ever do that, but maybe it's stuff that you don't want searchable on Google. So you could put on your website this robots.txt file, hey Google, don't include me in your search engine. And Google won't. Now it doesn't mean that someone else can't make a copy of your website and that will be there. But you can see this happening if, for example, you search for Facebook. I did this the other day. You want to say, oh, what does Facebook look like? It doesn't. Because Facebook blocks these archives. And so what is it that Facebook disallows? All these different search engines. It tells them what not to do. And this is probably it. IA Archiver is probably the Internet Archive. The privacy policy would be allowed, the data use policy is allowed, the legal terms is allowed, the policy.php allowed, everything else isn't. Is that right? So if we go to this and see, what was it now? Hold on, back. So we say copy. I thought it said it was allowed, but maybe I was wrong about that. Anyway, it seemed to say that was allowed, but I might be reading that wrong because I haven't configured these. But that's how you deal with it, not after the fact. If you have a client that it has sensitive content, doesn't want it, and by the way, it's not just a licensing issue. It's your client's own content. It needs to set up the website or contractually obligate the licensee to set up the website to block the search engines. And the search engines, the well-behaved search engines, will respect that to technical means. And that's the only way you could possibly deal with this in any meaningful way. Yeah. Nothing. Wait, which site? The archive site?
Right, right.
You can't stop them.
And,
anybody can do this, right? But the big ones, you can't, just like you can't stop people from taking a picture of the screen. But the likelihood of that being accessed is a lot less than the likelihood of it showing up on Google. This is about volume. This is about the main players, Yahoo and Baidu for China, you saw, and Internet Archive and the others, the ones people go to that have the possibility and have the technology to crawl through these sites and archive everything and keep them. Even Google doesn't go back, at least not the main Google page, 18 years. So this is not about prevention, right? It's not about absolute prevention, but it's about using your best commercially reasonable efforts to minimize the mass archiving and mass accessibility of this content. So we talked about, back to this discussion, we talked about geography and borders and the lack thereof. The ease of implementation. So it's very easy to post content with or without permission. Framing, I know it's a little bit, I have some slides. This is a weird one because it's not quite an explicit violation of, say, copyright. And if you read through the clicking through stuff, which was back when framing was really much more of a controversy. But what it essentially is picture in picture. And it's a technology trick. But what it enabled people to do was essentially take an entire website and put it within another website. And it meant that the owner of the frame could get the benefit of showing people what was inside the frame. I think the example that I used in clicking through was someone had a television broadcaster and just put a camera facing somebody else's channel and just rebroadcast. That's essentially what framing is. And I will show you an old example, but just to give you a sense of it. But what it means is that your client can't always know on which websites its content will appear. There are other challenges for internet licensing culture. The culture of information wants to be free. It's easy to copy. It should be legal to copy. Or I don't care because I just have to click and say save. There's very much a taker's culture as well as a maker's culture, but a taker's culture online. So other challenges, as I've discussed, taking things from another medium, posting it online, are the rights in place? There's a lot of challenge from lack of legal knowledge. Because the people you're dealing with, whether they're your clients or the other side to the transaction, may be very smart people. Maybe technologically adept people. But they may not understand the law, or worse, they may think they understand the law because they read it on Facebook. Remember when all those things about various laws were going around and people were saying, I'm posting this in my Facebook feed because otherwise, so in order to opt out of some odd law that says that my Facebook posting could be used for all sorts of things, and by posting this, I'm withholding my permission, and it was total legal nonsense, but it was everywhere. You have no idea what I'm talking about. You're shaking your head. You guys remember this? It was about a year or two ago. You would just see people who really didn't know what they were doing post this long legal language in their Facebook feeds because they had heard somehow that Facebook had changed its terms of service to allow them to resell their content, and by posting this on their Facebook feeds, they were opting out. And there were all these citations to laws that didn't exist. There's a lot of pseudo-knowledge about the law online. Users, business people. There's lack of technological knowledge, too. Your clients may not understand things like web.archive.org and proxies. And you may not be all that familiar with them either, at least hopefully in the context of this discussion and other things, you've gotten enough of a taste to say, okay, there may be things we don't get here. But that has, as you can see, direct legal implications on the risk assessment and risk management of licenses. So we got to know these things. Legislators pass all sorts of laws that just don't reflect it. Courts get it wrong. We see what the issue is with archives. And then international law, because what's legal here may be illegal there, and vice versa. Your client may have the right to use something here and not there. There are privacy concerns. Understanding all these ins and outs can be very difficult. So a few examples of how cross-licensing content online went, and I love this phrase, all pear-shaped. It went strange. Not recent, but really, really influential and important cases. So there was this case, oddly enough, and it was odd because Paul Allen was a co-founder of Microsoft, and then at the time was the major owner of Ticketmaster. So it was kind of a weird situation, but here's how this played out. Microsoft was launching its Sidewalk sites at the time. These were sort of the local cultural guides, everything guides, right? And they wanted, when talking about local concerts and local sports events, et cetera, they wanted to make it possible for people to easily purchase tickets for those events. They would be reading about a concert in Seattle or whatever, click to buy a ticket, go. And so they got into negotiations with Ticketmaster. Okay, Ticketmaster, we would like to create a strategic relationship where we will send you customers directly linked right to the purchase page for this event in this city on this date. And they negotiated, and they finally did not come to terms. They didn't agree. But Microsoft said, you know what? This is sufficiently useful. And sufficiently easy, and we don't have anybody else with whom we're going to do this deal and make some money, so we'll just set it up anyway. Why not? As a favor to our customers, right? We'll point them. We don't get anything for it because we couldn't come to terms with Ticketmaster. We will point them at that. Ticketmaster had a problem with this. Why? To this day, I have no idea. And what Ticketmaster did, first of all, they objected. And the objection was essentially, you are associating your brand with ours. It's somewhat of a trademark related issue. But you know what else Ticketmaster did? Ticketmaster could tell when users were coming from Microsoft Sidewalk site. And what Ticketmaster did was they set up their website so that every time someone came from a click of a link on Sidewalk, instead of going to the place to buy it, they would be redirected to a "you came from Sidewalk, we're not happy with you" website. Now the argument Ticketmaster said was, Microsoft, if you're pointing people just at the event, they don't get to see all the ads that we're charging, you know, that we're selling on the homepage. So instead of redirecting people to the homepage or putting ads on the event page, Ticketmaster decided they didn't want those sales, which was just a weird response. But understand, this was, they were negotiating a cross-license essentially, and they didn't. But they didn't need to. Microsoft didn't need the agreement to technically just link to people. You just set up a link. Affiliate programs are another kind of link, where if I want to get commissions, if I want to get money for selling a book, but I don't want to actually sell a book, I can put a link on my website to the book on Amazon.com, and the link has a code in it. And when they click on it and go and buy the book from Amazon, I get a commission. And there are all sorts of sites that do this. But you have real licensing issues because many times those links, maybe it's not the title of the book, maybe it's a banner ad for Amazon. It uses the other party's intellectual property. It's copyrighted images, it's trademarks. And there are potential issues with how those are being used. Are they being used in accordance with, you know, the brand that they want them to be used? Do they want to have this relationship? You know, does this very nice family-friendly product want to have its brand posted on a very unfamily-friendly website that someone could say, oh my God, you're doing business with them? So when companies set up affiliate programs, they actually put in place trademark restrictions. I'm going to show you framing in a second. Issues with online games, where you have content being licensed. You have issues where if there are virtual worlds and people are creating their own characters and their own environments, who has the rights to those? When Second Life was a thing, all these companies were putting together virtual storefronts in Second Life and building showrooms in Second Life. Second Life was a virtual world. And then there were questions of, okay, do we have the rights to show, to put these trademarks and these copyrighted images into Second Life in our virtual storefront? Prize promotions, contest sweepstakes, etc. There are a lot of challenges in terms of brands and how they're used, and copyrighted materials and how they're used. So I just want to sort of, we've talked about the international issues, so let me show you what Total News used to look like. This was really the first major situation where big players started realizing that technology made things strange. So this was, I know, it's very 1997. It's not a particularly fashionable thing today, but the idea here was this website aggregated links to news sites. Think of Google News today. You go to Google News and you see lots of links to lots of stories. Well, Google News didn't exist then. So instead you had Total News. And here you had on the right, you know, Fox, MSNBC, CBS, ABC, NandoNet, whatever that is, NPR, all these things, right? And then you had this. This is a menu bar. And then you have an ad. And then you have the Total News homepage. But if you clicked on one of these, when it first launched, you wouldn't go, it wasn't like Google News where it would open a window or go to another page. No, if you clicked on CBS, the CBS website would appear here. Framed by your little remote control and the Total News ad. Whatever ad they were selling. And if you were to say bookmark, favorite, that site, looking at CBS, what you'd end up with would be TotalNews.com.
What was the logic behind framing key people on your site?
Yeah. You know, but the problem was, and it wasn't even so much a copyright issue, because they weren't duplicating. This was literally a web page. You could scroll it, you would see the ads in it, but the problem was that smart people, including people I talked to, very strongly assumed that there was a business relationship between these sites and this site. And there wasn't. Total News just did this. They put these up, they chose. There was no negotiation. And you had to drill down two or three levels to see this. No relationships exist between Total News Inc. and the parent or subsidiary companies that own the third-party websites accessed by the user. But you wouldn't know that here. And so a number of these companies sued. They tried to make copyright claims, but in the end, what they were making were trademark claims. That there was an implied endorsement or affiliation, a misuse of their trademarks in a way that made it seem that they were doing business, that they had basically bought space in Total News. And when they brought those suits, what Total News did was everybody who brought a suit, if you clicked on their links, it would launch another window. But everybody else stayed in the middle. So how was this possible? It was possible because the people who then were at Netscape invented this thing called framing. And they made a technical possibility of doing framing, and they put it out there, and people used it. And they didn't necessarily think about the legal implications. Link liability is still a question. Not only how to get, whether you are liable for intellectual property infringement for linking, but I found this from late last year. Actually, turns out there's a case that linking to facts can actually help in a defamation case. I make this claim, and here's where I got it from. Here's a link to the original. And so if the site posting the claim is sued for defamation, it can say, well, here's your source. But it's still this idea of linking. And it's not just linking, it's also being able to pull content from other websites just by a code. Ahref equals, poof. And you're pulling an image from the original source, showing up in your web page. You're not making a copy, you're just instructing your user's computer to pull it from there. All of these things became newly possible, and the law has to address them, and there are technological solutions, and there are legal solutions. And so there are lots of, obviously, any kinds of strategies, and I'll post this, but these are the issues really you're talking about. So I hope that at least I've given you a sense that this really is different. The law is the same. There may be more countries' laws involved, but I'm not saying that the law doesn't apply. But it has to be applied in new ways because new uses and new infringements are possible. And in thinking about licensing, you need to think about those novelties, those differences. Questions? Have a good night.